The troll seemed not to hear him for a moment, then turned slowly, a slight smile creasing his face.
"A good morning to you, Simon friend," he said. "I am feeling completely well."
"Oh, I just... you were staring."
"Look."
Binnebik extended a stubby finger from the sleeve of his jacket, pointing into the east. Simon turned to look once more, shading his eyes. "I don't see anything."
"Be looking more closely. Look to the last peak, standing on your right hand. There."
He indicated an icy slope, thrown into shadow by the sun behind it. Simon stared for some time, unwilling to admit failure. A moment before he gave up in despair, he at last saw something. Dark lines running beneath the glassy face of the mountain, like facets in a gemstone. He squinted, trying to make out the details.
"Do you mean those shadows?"
he asked at last. Binnebik nodded, a rapt expression on his face.
"Well,"
Simon demanded, "what are they?"
"More than shadows," Binnebik said quietly. "What you are there seeing are the towers of Lust Tomete."
"Towers inside the mountain?
And what's Tomete?"
Binnebik frowned mockingly.
"Simon, you have been hearing its name several times. What kind of student did Dr. Morganis take on? Are you remembering when I spoke with Jeriki of the Oakiza Tomate, ni Rianis?"
"Sort of," Simon said uncomfortably. "What is it?"
"The song of the fall of the city of Tomate, one of the great nine cities of the city. That song is telling the tale of Tomate's abandonment. Those shadows you see are its towers, imprisoned in many thousand years of ice."
"Truly?"
Simon stared at the dark vertical blurs that ran like stains beneath the milky ice. He tried to see them as towers, but could not.
"Why did they abandon it?" he asked.
Binnebik ran his hand along the fur of Kantaka's back.
"A number of reasons there are, Simon. If you like, I will tell you part of its story later, when we are riding. It will be a help for passing the time."
"Why did they build this city on an icy mountain in the first place?" Simon asked. "That seems stupid."
Binnebik looked up peevishly.
"You are speaking, Simon, to one raised in the mountains, as you are no doubt able to recall. Part of manhood, I am thinking, is to ponder one's words before opening one's mouth."
"I'm sorry."
Simon tried to suppress a mischievous smile.
"I didn't realize the trolls actually liked living where they do."
"Simon,"
Binnebik said sternly,
"I think it would be a good thing if you went to gather up the horses."
"So, Binnebik," Simon said at last, "what are the nine cities?"
They had been riding for an hour, tilting away at last from the base of the mountains and out onto the vast, wide sea of the waste, following the line of what Binnebik called the Old Tomate Road, a broad causeway that had once linked the ice-bound city with its sisters to the south. There was little to see of any road now, only a few large stones still standing on either side of the trail, and an occasional patch of cobbles still in place beneath the covering snow. Simon had not asked the question out of any real eagerness to learn more history. His head was already crammed so full of strange names and places, he could scarcely hold a thought. But the featureless terrain, the endless field of snow dotted with forlorn stands of trees, made him hungry for a story. Binnebik, who had ridden slightly ahead, whispered something to Kantaka. Leaking plumes of vaporous breath, the wolf stopped in her wide tracks until Simon had caught up. Simon's mare shied and pranced away. As Kantaka crunched inoffensively alongside, Simon patted the horse's neck, speaking low words of encouragement. After a few head-swinging paces, she was able to continue her progress with nothing more than an occasional nervous snort. For her part, the wolf paid no attention to the horse at all, her head held low as she sniffed at the snow.
"Good, Homefinder, good!"
Simon ran his hand down her shoulder, feeling the tremendous muscles moving beneath his fingers. He had named her, and now she obeyed him. He felt himself filled with quiet joy. She was his horse now. Binnebig smiled at Simon's prideful expression.
"You show her respect. That is a good thing," he said. "Too often it is that men think those who serve are doing it from inferiorness or weakness."
He chuckled.
"Folk who have those beliefs should ride a mount like Kentucka, who could eat them if she chose. They would then be learning humbleness."
He scratched the ridge of fur between Kantaka's shoulders. The wolf stopped pacing for a moment to appreciate the attention, then dug forward through the snow once more. Sludig, riding just ahead, turned to look back.
"Ah, you'll be a horseman as well as a fighter, is that right? Our friend Snowlock is the boldest kitchen boy in the world."
Simon scowled, embarrassed, and felt his skin wrinkling around his cheek scar.
"That's not my name."
Sludig laughed at his discomfiture.
"And what is wrong with Simon Snowlock for a name? It is a true name, honorably one."
"If it is displeasing, Simon friend," Binnebig said kindly, "we will call you some other thing. But Sludig speaks rightly. Your name was gained with honor, given to you by Jiriki of the highest Scythi house. The Scythi are seeing more clearly than mortals, at least in some ways. Like any of their other gifts, a name is not to be discarded with easiness. Do you remember when you held the white arrow above the river?"
Simon did not have to think hard. The moment when he had fallen into the turbulent Aelfwent, despite all the strange adventures he had suffered since, remained a black spot in his memory. It had been his idiot pride, of course, the other side of his moon-carved nature, that had sent him down into the swirling depths. He had been trying to show Miriamel how lightly he regarded even the gifts of the Scythi. The very thought of his foolishness made him feel ill. What an ass he was! How could he ever hope Miriamel could care about him? "I remember," was all he said. But the joy of his moment was gone. Anyone could ride a horse, even a moon calf. Why should he grow so large in his own estimation, just because he had kept an already battle-hardened mare from balking? "You were going to tell me about the nine cities, Binnebig," he said heavily. The troll lifted an eyebrow at Simon's despairing tone, but did not pursue the subject. Instead, he brought Kantaka to a halt.
"Turn for a moment and be looking back,"
the troll said, gesturing to both Simon and Sludig. The Rimmer's man made an impatient noise, but did as Binnebig asked. The sun had pulled free from the mountain's embrace. Its slanting rays now blazed along the face of the easternmost peak, laying fire along its icy cheek, and throwing deep shadows in the crevices. The imprisoned towers, dark streaks at dawn, now seemed to glow with warm, reddish light, like blood running through the mountain's cold arteries.
"Look well," Binnebig said. "We may none of us be ever seeing that sight again. Tomete was a place of highest magic, as were all the great cities of the Scythi. Their like will never again come to the light."
The troll took a deep breath, then suddenly and startlingly burst out into song.
"Senai mezu yeru, ikudo sachu ra, o doini hehuru, tomete zi inu asuna. Shemiseyu nonne temoya."
Benebik's voice carried out through the windless morning, disappearing with no answering echo.
"That is the beginning of the song of Tomate's fall, he said solemnly. A very old song, and one of which I am knowing only a few verses. That one I have sung means this. Towers of scarlet and silver, the day stars herald, you have slipped into cold shadows. Tomate, hall of dawn, first mourned and last forgotten.
The troll shook his head.
It is so much difficulty for me to make things of Scythi craft into proper words, especially in a tongue not of my birthplace. You can be forgiving, I hope.
He grinned sourly.
In any case, most Scythi songs have as their root thoughts of loss and long memory. So how is a person of my short years to make their words sing?
Simon was staring at the almost invisible towers, fading streaks in the prisoning ice. Where did the Scythi go who lived there? He asked. The mournful words of Binnabig's songs echoed in his thoughts.
You have slipped into cold shadows.
He could feel those shadows tightening around his heart like bands of ice.
You have slipped into cold shadows.
His face throbbed, where the dragon's blood had marked him.
Where the Scythi always go,
the troll replied.
Away to lesser places. They die or pass into shade, or live and become less than they were.
He stopped, eyes downcast, as he strove to find the proper words.
They were bringing much that had beauty into the world, Simon. And much that was beautiful in the world was admired by them. It has been many times said that the world grows less fair because of their diminishing. I do not have the knowledge to tell if that is so.
He thrust his hands into Kantaka's thick pelt and urged her about once more, cantering away from the mountains.
I wanted you to remember that place, Simon. But do not grieve. Still, there is being much of beauty in this world.
Sludig made the sign of the tree above his cloaked breast.
I cannot say I share your love of these magical places, troll.
He snapped his reins, urging his horse into a walk. The good Lord Osiris came to free us from paganism.
It is no accident that the heathen demons who threaten our world are cousins to these Scythi you mourn for.
Simon felt a surge of anger.
That's stupid, Sludig. What about Jiriki? Is he a demon?
The Rimmer's man turned to him, an unhappy smile flashing in his blonde beard.
No, youngling. But neither is he a magical playmate and protector, as you seem to think him. Jiriki is older and deeper than any of us can know. Like many such things, he is also more dangerous than mortals can know. God knew what he did when he aided mankind to scourge the Scythi from this land. Jiriki has been fair, but his people and ours can never live together. We are too different.
Simon choked back a furious response, turning his eyes to the snowy path before them. Sometimes he did not like Sludig very much at all. They rode on for a while, silent but for the chuffing of breath and the scraping of their horses' hooves, before Binnabig spoke again.
You have been having luck of great rarity, Simon, he said.
Being chased by demons, you mean? Simon growled. Or seeing my friends killed?
Please.
The troll raised his small hand in a calming gesture.
I do not refer to luckiness of that sort. Clearly, it has been a terrible road we have walked. No, I meant only that you have seen 3 of the 9 great cities. Few, if any, mortals can be making such a statement with truthfulness.
Which 3?
Tomate, of which you have just seen all that is left to see. Now that ice has buried her.
The troll spread his fingers, counting.
Dai Chekiza in Aldeota Forest, where I received my unfortunate arrowing, and Aswa itself, whose bones are the underpinnings of the Hayholt where you had your birth.
The Scythi built Green Angel Tower there, and it's still standing, Simon said, remembering its pale sweep, like a white finger pointing at the sky. I used to climb it all the time, he thought for a moment. Was that other place, the one called Enki-e
Shaose?
Benebik prompted.
Yes, was Enki-e Shaose one of the great cities?
It was, and we shall see its ruins too, one day, if any remain. For it is near to where we will be finding the Stone of Farewell.
He leaned low as Kantaka leaped up and over a small rise.
I've seen it already, Simon said. Jariki showed it to me in the mirror. It was beautiful, all green and gold. He called it the Summer City.
Benevik smiled.
Then you have seen four, Simon. Few of even the wisest ones can say as much after a whole length of life.
Simon considered this. Who would ever have dreamed that Morgani's history lessons would be so important? Old cities and old stories were now part of his very life. It was strange how the future seemed tied inseparably to the past, so that both revolved through the present, like a great wheel.
The wheel. The shadow of the wheel.
An image from a dream rose before him, a great black circle pushing relentlessly downward, a huge wheel that drove everything before it. Somehow the past was forcing its way right into this very moment, casting a long shadow across the what would be. Something was there in his mind, but just beyond reach. Some occult shape that he could feel but not recognize. It was something about his dreams, something about past and future.
I think I need to know more, Benebik, he said at last. But there are so many things to understand, I'll never remember them all. What were the other cities?
He was momentarily distracted by a movement in the sky before him. A scatter of dark moving shapes like breeze-blown leaves. He squinted, but saw that it was only a flock of high-soaring birds.
About the past is a good thing to know, Simon, said the little man. But it is deciding which things are important that separates a wise one from others. Still, although it is my guessing that the names of the nine cities will be little use, it is good to know of them. Once their names were known to every child in its cradle. Aswa, Dai Chekiza, Enki-e Shaose, and Tumate you are knowing. Tina Tsenai lies drowned beneath the southern seas. The ruins of Kementari stand somewhere on Warrenstern Island. Birth home of your king, Prester John. But no one, I think, has seen them for years and years. Also long unseen are Mesutua and Hikehikeo, both lost beneath Austin Ard's northwestern mountains. The last, Nakika, now that my thought is upon it. You have already seen as well. Or you have in a way.
What does that mean?
Nakika was the city the Norns built long ago in the shadow of Stormspike, before they were retreating into the great Ice Mountain itself. On the Dream Road with Jeloi and myself, you visited it, but doubtless you overlooked its crumbling remains beside the mountain's immensity. So in a way, then, you have visited Nakika also.
Simon shuddered, remembering a vision of the endless icy halls within Stormspike. of the ghost-white faces and burning eyes that shone in its depths.
"That was as close as I ever want to be," he said.
He squinted his eyes, staring at the sky. The birds still circled lazily overhead.
"Are those ravens?" he asked Benabik, pointing.
"They've been staying just above our heads for some time."
The troll looked upward.
"Ravens, yes, and large ones they are as well."
He grinned wickedly.
"Perhaps they are waiting for us to fall down very dead, and so aid them in their searching for sustenance. A pity it is to disappoint them, is it not?"
Simon grunted. "Maybe they can tell I'm starving, that I won't last much longer."
Binnebik nodded solemnly.
"How thoughtless I am being. Of course, Simon, it is indeed true that you have had no food since breaking your fast. And chuckle stones, you poor fellow. That has been an hour ago. You must be fast approaching the awful moment of finalness."
Finished with this bit of sarcasm, he began to rummage in his pack, steadying himself against Kantaka's back with his other hand.
"Perhaps I can discover for you some dried fish."
"Thank you."
Simon tried to sound enthusiastic. After all, any food was better than no food. As Binnebik performed his laborious search, Simon looked up at the sky once more. The swarm of black birds still hovered silently, wind-tossed beneath the somber clouds, like tattered rags. The raven strutted on the windowsill, feathers fluffed against the chill air. Others of his kind, grown fat and insolent on gibbet leavings, crowed raucously in the leafless branches beyond the window. No other sounds drifted up from the silent, deserted courtyard. Even as it preened its shiny black feathers, the raven kept a bright yellow eye cocked. When the goblet came flying toward it like a slingstone, it had more than enough time to drop from the sill with a harsh cry, spreading its wings to flutter up and join its kin in the barren treetop. The dented goblet rolled in an uneven circle on the stone floor before lurching to a halt. A thin wisp of steam rose from the dark liquor that had splattered beneath the windowsill.
"I hate their eyes," King Elias said.
He reached for a fresh goblet, but used this one for its proper and intended purpose.
"Those damn sneaking yellow eyes."
He wiped his lip.
"I think they're spying on me."
"Spying, Majesty?" Guthwulf said slowly. He did not want to send Elias into one of his thunderstorm rages.
"Why would birds spy?"
The High King fixed him with a green stare, then a grin split his pale face.
"Oh, Guthwulf, you are so innocent, so undefiled."
He chuckled harshly.
"Come, pull that chair closer. It is good to speak with an honest man once more."
The Earl of Utenyi did as his king bade him, sliding forward until less than an ell separated his stool from the yellowing mass of the dragonbone chair. He kept his eyes averted from the black scabbarded sword that hung at the High King's side.
"I do not know what you mean by innocent, Elias," he said, inwardly cursing the stiffness he heard in his own voice. "God knows we have both of us labored mightily in the chapel of sin in our time. However, if you mean innocent of any treachery toward my king and friend, then I accept the name gladly."
He hoped he sounded more certain than he felt. The very word treachery made his heart gallop these days, and the rotting fruit hanging from the distant gibbet was only one reason. Elias seemed to sense none of Guthwulf's misgivings.
"No, old friend, no. I meant the word kindly."
He took another swig of the dark liquid.
"There are so few I can trust these days. I have 1,000,000 enemies."
The king's face took on a brooding cast, which only accentuated his pallor, the lines of weariness and strain.
"Priorities is gone to Nevern, as you know," he said at last. "You may speak freely."
Guthwulf felt a sudden spark of hope. "Do you suspect Priorities of treachery, sire?" The spark was quickly extinguished.
"No, Guthwulf, you misunderstand me. I meant that I know you are not comfortable around the priest. That is not surprising. I once found his company difficult as well. But I am a different man now. A different man."
The king laughed oddly, then raised his voice to a shout.
"Hang fish! Bring me more, and be swift, damn you!"
The king's new cupbearer appeared from the next room, a sloshing ewer in his pink hands. Guthwulf watched him sourly. Not only was he positive that this pop-eyed brother Hengfisk was a spy for Priorities, but there was something else gravely wrong with him as well. The monk's face seemed forever fixed in an idiot grin, as though he were burning up inside with some splendid joke he could not share. The Earl of Utanyit had tried to speak to him once in the hallway, but Hengfisk had only stared at him, unspeaking, his smile so wide it seemed his face might split in half. With any other servitor but the king's cupbearer, Guthwulf would have struck him for such insolence. But he was uneasy about what Elias might take offense at these days. Also, there was an unpleasant look to the half-witted monk, his skin slightly raw, as though the upper layer had burned and peeled away. Guthwulf was in no hurry to touch him. As Hengfisk poured the dark liquid into the king's goblet, a few smoking drops spattered onto the monk's hands, but the cupbearer did not flinch. A moment later he scuttled out, still wearing his lunatic grin. Guthwulf restrained a shudder. Insanity. What had the kingdom come to? Elias had ignored the whole episode, his eyes fixed on something beyond the window.
"Priorities does have secrets," he said at last, slowly, as though carefully considering each word.
The Earl forced himself to pay attention.
"But he has none from me," the king continued, "whether he realizes it or not. One thing he thinks I do not know is that my brother Josue survived the fall of Neglamund."
He raised a hand to still Guthwulf's exclamation of surprise.
"Another secret that is no secret. He plans to do away with you."
"Me?" Guthwulf was caught by surprise. "Priorities plans to kill me?" The anger that welled within him had a core of sudden fear. The king smiled, lips pulling back from his teeth, like the grin of a cornered dog.
"I do not know if he plans to kill you, Wolf, but he wishes you out of the way. Priorities thinks I place too much trust in you, when he deserves all my attention."
He laughed, a harsh bark.
But Elias,
Guthwulf was caught off stride.
"What will you do?" "Me?"
The king's gaze was unnervingly calm.
"I will do nothing, and neither will you."
"What?" Elias leaned back into his throne, so that for a moment his face vanished in the shadow beneath the great dragon's skull.
"You may protect yourself, of course," he said cheerfully. "I merely mean I cannot allow you to kill Priorities, assuming you could, which isn't something I'm too certain of. Quite frankly, old friend, at this moment, he is more important to me than you are."
The king's words hung in the air, seeming so much the stuff of madness that for a moment Guthwulf felt sure he was dreaming. As moments passed, and the chill room did not waver into some other shape, he had to force himself to speak once more.
"I don't understand." "Nor should you. Not yet."
Elias leaned forward, his eyes bright as lamps burning behind thin green glass.
"But someday you will, Guthwulf. I hope you live to understand everything. At this time, though, I cannot let you interfere with Priorities, so if you feel you must leave the castle, I will understand." You are the only friend I have left. Your life is important to me.
The Earl of Utanyit wanted to laugh at such a bizarre statement, but the sense of sick unreality would not leave him.
But not as important to you as Priorities?
The king's hand leaped out like a striking serpent, fastening on Guthwulf's sleeve.
Don't be a fool, he rasped. Priorities is nothing. It is what Priorities is helping me to do that matters. I told you that there were great things coming, but there will be a time first when things are changing.
Guthwulf stared at the king's feverish face and felt something die within him.
I have sensed some of the changes, Elias, he said grimly. I have seen others.
His old friend looked back at him, then smiled oddly.
Ah, the castle, you mean? Yes, some of the changes are happening right here. But you still do not understand.
Guthwulf was not practiced in patience. He fought to hold down his rage.
Help me to understand. Tell me what you do.
The king shook his head.
You could not possibly make sense of it. Not now, not this way.
He sat back again, his face sliding into shadow once more, so that it almost seemed as though the great fanged and black-socketed head was his own. A stretching silence followed. Guthwulf listened to the bleak voices of ravens in the courtyard.
Come here, old friend, Elias said at last, voice slow and measured.
As Guthwulf looked up, the king slid his double-hilted sword partway from its scabbard. The metal gleamed darkly, black and crawling grey like the mottled belly of some ancient reptile. The ravens abruptly fell silent.
Come here, the king repeated.
The Earl of Utanyit could not tear his eyes from the sword. The rest of the room became grey and insubstantial. The sword itself seemed to glow without light, to make the very air heavy as stone.
Will you kill me now, Elias?
Guthwulf felt his words grow weighty, each one an effort to use.
Will you save Priorities his trouble?
Touch the sword, Guthwulf, Elias said.
His eyes seemed to shine more brightly as the room darkened.
Come and touch the sword. Then you will understand.
No,
Guthwulf said weakly, but watched with horror as his arm moved forward, as if by its own will.
I don't want to touch the damned thing.
Now his hand hovered just above the ugly, slow, shimmering blade.
Damned thing. Elias laughed,
his voice seeming far away. He reached out and took his friend's hand, gentle as a lover.
You can't begin to guess. Do you know what its name is?
Guthwulf watched his fingers slowly flatten against the bruised surface of the sword. A deadening chill crept up his arm, countless icy needles pricking his flesh. Close behind the cold came a fiery blackness. Elias' voice seemed to be falling away into the distance.
Jingizu is its name, the king called. Its name is Sorrow.
And in the midst of the dreadful fog that enwrapped his heart, through the blanket of frost that covered and then entered his eyes and ears and mouth, Guthwulf felt the sword's dreadful song of triumph. It hummed right through him, softly at first, but growing ever stronger, a terrible, potent music that matched and then devoured his rhythms, that drowned out his weak and artless notes, until it had absorbed the entire song of his soul into its darkly triumphant tune. Sorrow sang inside him, filling him. He heard it cry out with his voice, as though he had become the sword, or the sword had somehow become Guthwulf. Sorrow was alive and looking for something. Guthwulf was looking too. He had now been subsumed in the alien melody. He and the blade were one. Sorrow reached for its brothers. He found them. Two shining forms were there, just beyond his reach. Garthwulf longed to be with them, to join his proud melody to theirs, so that together they would make a music greater still. He yearned, a bloodless, warmthless desire, like a cracked bell straining to toll, like a lodestone aching for true north. They were three of a kind, he and these other two. Three songs unlike any the world had heard, but each was incomplete without its fellows. He stretched toward his brothers as though to touch them, but they were too far away. Mere distance still separated them. No matter how he strained, Garthwulf could not bring them closer, could not join with them. At last, the delicate balance collapsed, sending him plunging down into an infinite nothingness, falling, falling, falling. Slowly, he came to himself again. Garthwulf, a man born of woman, but still he fell through blackness. He was terrified. Time sped. He felt grave worms eating his flesh, felt himself coming apart deep within the black earth, rendered into innumerable particles that ached to scream without voices to do so. At the same moment, like a rushing wind, he flew laughing past the stars and into the endless places between life and death. For a moment, the very door of mystery swung open, and a dark shadow stood beckoning in the doorway. Long after Elias had sheathed the sword, Garthwulf still lay choking on the steps before the dragonbone chair, his eyes burning with tears, his fingers helplessly flexing.
Not some other bird they are chasing.
Now Simon could see it too, a smaller grey shape that flitted among the black ones, darting wildly, now this way, now that. At every turn it seemed to find one of the larger birds already there. It was tiring, Simon could see plainly, its loops becoming ever more ragged, its escapes narrower.
It's a sparrow, Simon cried, like the ones Morgaine's had. They're going to kill it.
Even as he spoke, the swooping circle of ravens seemed to sense that the quarry was nearing its limits. The whirling funnel contracted, and the croaking voices rose, as if in triumph. Then, just when it seemed the hunt was over, the sparrow found an open space and burst free of the black ring, darting unevenly toward a stand of fir trees half a furlong away. The ravens, shrieking, whirled in pursuit.
"I do not think it chance that such a bird should be here,"
Binnabik said, unscrewing his walking stick to shake free his pouch of darts.
"Or that the ravens would be waiting with such patientness just where we are."
He grabbed Kantaka's hackles.
"Chok, Kantaka!" he cried. "Omo, chok!"
The wolf sprang away, churning the snow beneath her broad paws. Sludig dug in his heels, and his mount leaped after her. Simon, cursing beneath his breath, wrestled for a moment with Homefinder's reins. By the time he had them sorted out, she had decided to follow Sludig's horse anyway. Simon clung to her neck as they pounded over the uneven snow, hoof-churned sleet burning his eyes. The ravens were circling the corpse like a swarm of black bees. Binnabik, in the lead, vanished among the close-standing trunks. Sludig went just after, his spear now in his hand. Simon had a moment to wonder how the Rimmer's man would kill birds with a heavy spear. Then the line of trees was looming before him as well. He pulled up on the reins, slowing his horse. He ducked his head beneath the low-hanging branch, but was not fast enough to avoid a clump of snow falling into the loose hood of his cloak and slithering down his neck. Binnabik stood beside Kantaka at the center of the copse, the hollow tube to his mouth. The troll's cheeks puffed. A moment later, a large black bundle fell down through the branches overhead, flapping in a slow circle on the white ground before it died.
"There,"
Binnabik said, gesturing. Sludig poked upward with his spear, rattling its point among the tree limbs, as Kantaka gave vent to a sharp, excited bark. A black wing skimmed by Simon's face. The raven struck at the back of Sludig's head, its claws scrabbling impotently against the metal of his helm. Another one swooped down from above, squawking, whirling about the Rimmersman's arms as he plied the spear. "Why aren't I wearing a helmet?" Simon thought disgustedly as he raised his hand before his suddenly vulnerable eyes. The little copse raged with the angry voices of birds. Kentucka had her front paws up on a tree trunk, shaking her head from side to side, as if she had already caught one of them. Something small and still, as a tiny snowball, dropped from the tree overhead. Binnabig fell to his knees at the Rimmer's man's feet and cupped it in his hands.
"I have it," he cried. "Let us be going into the open. So, sir, Kentucka."
He clambered onto the wolf's back, his hand now tucked inside his jacket. He had to duck beneath the onslaught of one of the ravens. The haft of Sludig's spear whistled through the space his head had just vacated, smacking the bird like a club, shattering it into a puff of dark feathers. A moment later, the wolf had carried Binnabig out from beneath the trees. Simon and Sludig quickly followed. Despite the angry voices of the birds behind them, the open ground outside seemed remarkably still to Simon. He turned to look back. Hard yellow eyes stared from the uppermost branches. But the ravens did not follow.
"You saved the bird?" he asked.
"Let us be riding farther away," Binnabig said. "Then we will look to what we have."
When they stopped, the troll took his hand from beneath his skin jacket. He opened it slowly, as though not sure what he might find there. The bird nestled inside was dead, or nearly so. It lay on its side unstirring, its ragged wounds striped with blood. There was a shred of parchment about its leg.
"I was thinking this could be," Binnabig said,
looking over his shoulder. The dark silhouettes of a dozen ravens sat like hunch-shouldered inquisitors in the nearest tree.
"I am afraid that we are more late than we should have been."
His small finger unfurled the parchment. It had been chewed or torn until but a part of it remained.
"A fragment only," Binnabig said sadly.
Simon looked at the tiny runes dotting the ragged strip. "We could go back to the trees and look for the rest," he said, disliking the idea mightily, even as he said it. The troll shook his head.
"I have a sureness that the rest has found its way down a raven gullet, as would this scrap too, and the messenger, if we had been later still."
He squinted at it.
"Few words am I making out, but I feel no doubt it was meant for us. See?"
He pointed at a minute squiggle.
"The circle and feather of the League of the Scroll. It was sent by a scroll-bearer."
"Who?" Simon asked.
"Patience, Simon friend. Perhaps the remaining message will tell."
He held the curling strip as flat as he could.
"Two bits only can I read," he said. "This saying, three of false messengers. And this, make haste, the storm is spru. Then it is signed below with the League's mark."
"False messenger," Simon breathed, dread creeping through him. "That was the dream I had in Jaloe's house. Dr. Morganis told me to beware the false messenger." He tried to push away the memory of that dream. In it, the doctor had been a charred corpse.
"Be wary of false messengers is then what it is likely meaning," Binnabig said, nodding his head. "Make haste, the storm is spreading, I am supposing."
The great fear Simon had kept suppressed for several days came crawling back. "False messenger," he repeated helplessly. "What can it mean? Who wrote it, Binnabig?" The troll shook his head. He tucked the sliver of parchment in his bag and then kneeled, scraping a hole in the snow.
"It is a scroll-bearer, and there are not many now alive. It might be Yarnauga, if he still lives. There is also Dinevan in Naben.
He laid the little grey bird in the hole and tenderly covered it over.
Denevan?
Simon asked.
He is the helper of the Lector Ranesin, the head of your mother church,
Binnebik said.
A very good man.
Sludig, who had stood silent, suddenly spoke.
The Lector is part of your heathen circle? He said wonderingly. With trolls and such?
Binnebik smiled a tiny smile.
Not the Lector. Father Denevan, his helper. And it is not a heathen circle, Sludig, but a band of those who wish the preserving of important knowledge. For just such times as these are.
He frowned.
I am thinking of who else it might be who was writing this message to us. Or to me, rather, for it is my master's arts that likely drew the bird here to me. If not one of the two I mentioned, then I cannot be saying, for Morgainis and my master O.K. Cook are dead. There are no other scroll-bearers I know of, unless new ones have been chosen.
Could it be Jaloi? Simon asked. Binnebik thought for a moment, then shook his head.
She is one of the wisest of the wise, but she has never been a true scroll-bearer, and I am doubting she would use the League's rune in place of her own.
He mounted up onto Kantaka's back.
We will think of the meaning of this warning as we ride. There are many messengers who have led us to this place, and many others we will doubtlessly be meeting in days and weeks to come, which are false. It is a puzzle of great difficulty.
Look, the ravens are flying, Sludig cried.
Simon and Binnebik turned to see the birds swarm up from the stand of trees like smoke, swirling in the grey sky before wheeling away into the northwest, their disdainful voices echoing.
They have done what they were sent for doing, Binnebik said. Now they are headed back to Stormspike, do you suppose?
Simon's cold fear deepened.
You mean the Storm King sent them after us?
I have little doubt that they were meant to keep that message from our eyes,
Binnebik said, leaning forward to pick his walking stick from the ground. Simon turned to follow the flight of the vanishing ravens. He almost expected to see a dark figure looming on the northern horizon, a burning red gaze in a faceless black head.
Those storm clouds on the horizon look very dark, Simon said. A lot darker than they did before.
The lad's right, Sludig glowered. That's an ugly storm gathering.
Binnebik sighed. His round face was grim, too.
The last part of the message we all of us understand. The storm is spreading, in more than one way only. We have a long journeying ahead, over open and unprotected country. We will need to go with all the speed that we can be making.
Kantaka started ahead. Simon and Sludig spurred their horses forward. Prompted by something he did not understand, Simon looked back once more, although he knew what he would see. The ravens, now little more than black specks on the wind, were fading from sight into the dark swell of the gathering storm. Chapter 13. The Stallion Clan. The prince's company came out at last onto the plains after nearly a month in the vast, ancient forest. As they broke through the last line of trees, the grasslands opened before them, a floor of uneven turf shrouded by morning mist, merging seamlessly with the grey horizon. Father Strangyard sped his pace to catch up with Jaloi. The witchwoman was striding purposefully out onto the flatland, wet stems falling before her approach.
Valada Jaloi, Strangyard said breathlessly. Ah, this is a marvellous book Morgainis has written. Marvellous!
Vallada Jaloi, have you read this passage?
He tried to juggle the loose pages, stumbled over a tussock, and only barely retained his balance.
I think there is something here of importance. Ah, how silly of me, how foolish. There are many things of importance. What a marvellous book!
Jaloi put her hand on Leleth's shoulder, bringing the child to a halt. The little girl did not look up, but stood where she had stopped, staring out into the mists.
Strangyard, you will do yourself an injury,
Jaloi said brusquely. She looked at him expectantly.
Well?
Oh, dear, the archivist said. He tucked at his eye patch self-consciously, almost losing his armful of pages in the process.
I didn't want you to stop walking. I can read and still keep up. I repeat, you will do yourself an injury. Read.
Before Strangyard could do so, they were interrupted by new arrivals.
Praise God,
Isorn cried. He and Deornoth struggled out of the trees upslope.
We are out of the cursed forest and on open ground.
The pair carefully set down the litter they had been dragging, glad to rest Sangfugl's weight for a moment. Under the witchwoman's ministrations, the harper was healing well, and swiftly from what should have been a fatal corruption of his blood. But he still could not walk more than a few hours at a time. Jaloi turned to look back.
Praise God, all you wish, she warned. But we may regret the loss of those sheltering trees before long.
The rest of the party limped down out of the woods. Prince Joshua was helping Towser, who walked dazed and unspeaking. The old man's eyes were rolled up as though he contemplated a distant heaven hidden behind the fog-blanketed sky. Vosheva and Duchess Gutrun walked a little way behind them.
It has been many years since I have seen the Thrivings, Joshua said, even this tamer part. I had almost forgotten its beauty.
He closed his eyes in thought for a moment, then opened them once more to gaze out toward the indistinct horizon.
It is like no other land in all of Austin Ard. Some call it God's Tabletop. If this is indeed God's Tabletop, Sangfugl said with a weak smile, my prince, he uses us for dice. Aiden, save me, I am meant to sing of Jack Mundwoder and his naughty bandits, not ape their forest traipsing.
He struggled out of the litter.
I need to get out of this thumping, bouncing, torture device and sit down. No, the grass is fine for me. I fear my sore leg more than the wet. Some gratitude, Isorn said, smiling. I think I shall show you what thumping really is, Harper.
Very well, Joshua said. We shall rest. No one stray far. And if you go more than a stone's throw, take someone with you.
So we have escaped the forest, Deornoth sighed. If only Einskalde could have seen it.
He thought of the Rimmersman's grave in one of the quiet glades of Shaseiron, a simple mound marked only by his helmet and Strangyard's wooden tree. Even Jaloi's healing skills had not been enough to save him from the terrible wounds he had received, leading their escape from the Norns. Now, fierce Einskaldia would lie forever in a place of timeless calm.
He was a stern bastard, bless him.
Deornoth shook his head.
He never gave up either.
But I don't think he believed we would ever get away.
We wouldn't have if not for him, Isorn said. He's another mark on the list.
List?
The list of what is owed to our enemies. To Skali and Elias and all the rest.
Isorn's broad face was grim.
We owe them a blood feud. Someday they will pay for what they did. And when it happens, Einskaldir will be watching in heaven and laughing.
Deornoth could think of nothing to say. If Einskaldir could watch battles from heaven, he would be laughing. For all his piety, it seemed a shame that Einskaldir had missed the old pagan days of Rimmersgard, and would instead be forced to spend his eternity in the quieter environs of Aiden's paradise. As the others milled about, Vosheva said a quiet word to Duchess Gutrun, then walked down the short slope and onto the damp meadow. She moved as if in a kind of dream, her eyes fixed on nothing, her track aimless and elliptical, as she made her way through the damp grasses.
"Vosheva," Joshua called, his voice sharper than usual. "Do not go alone. The mist is very thick and you would soon be out of sight."
"She would have to go very far before she would be out of earshot, Prince Joshua," said Duchess Gutrun, leading Towser with a gentle hand on his elbow.
"That may be," Joshua said, "but I would prefer we were not stumbling through the fog, shouting our presence to any listening ears. Surely you have not so soon forgotten our escort from Naglamund."
Gutrun shook her head in dismay, conceding the point. Vosheva, seemingly oblivious to the discussion, was now only a dim, upright shape slipping through the mists like a ghost.
"Damn her forwardness," Joshua said grimly, staring after her. "I will go with her."
Jaloi turned to Gutrun.
"Keep the child close to you, please."
She pointed Leleth in the general direction of the Duchess, then strode off after the fast-fading Vosheva. Joshua watched her go, then laughed unhappily.
"If this is the way I command a kingdom of 9 or 10, he told Deonoth, "then my brother can rest easily on the dragonbone chair. People used to beg to do my father John's bidding."
Even his queen, Deonoth wondered, but he did not say it. He watched the dark shape of Jaloi catch up to the wraith that was Vosheva. "If you have a proud and headstrong woman, you would be better off not to judge your success by her obedience."
"Please, my lord," he said instead, "do not speak ill of yourself. You are hungry and tired and cold. Let me build a fire."
"No, Deonoth."
Joshua rubbed the stump of his wrist as though it hurt.
"We will not stay so long."
He turned to look back at the forest fringe and the gaping shadows that lined it.
"We must move farther before we do more than pause to rest. We will stop somewhere that puts us in open ground on all sides. At least then, even though we are exposed, anything that stalks us will be exposed as well."
"A happy thought," grunted Sangfugel from his seat on the turf.
"Struth, but we are a merry band of pilgrims." "Pilgrims on the road through hell cannot afford too much merriment," Joshua said.
He strode a little way out onto the greensward to stand by himself in thought.
"Then why don't you tell him?"
There was exasperation in Jaloa's voice, but her hawk-yellow eyes betrayed little emotion.
"By bough and branch, Vosheva, you are not a young girl, you are a woman. Why do you carry on so?"
Vosheva's eyes were moist.
"I do not know. I cannot understand him."
Jaloi shook her head.
"I cannot understand any of you. I have spent little of my life with human folk, and it is because of this ridiculous uncertainty. I want this. I do not want that. The animals are more sensible, it seems to me. They do what they must, and do not fret over what cannot be changed."
The witch-woman laid a calloused hand on Vosheva's arm.
"Why do you worry so about things that do not matter? Prince Joshua obviously cares for you. Why do you not tell him the truth?"
Her companion sighed.
"He thinks me a foolish wagon girl. It makes him cold to me. If I tell him, it will only be worse. I am sorry."
She angrily wiped at her face with her tattered sleeve.
"It was seeing the Feluwalt again. That is what my people call this place, where the meadow runs in the forest's shadow. It brought many memories to my mind and made me unhappy."
"Vlade Jaloi,"
it was Father Strangyard's voice, sourceless in the mist but quite near.
"Are you there? Vlade Jaloi?"
A little frustration showed itself on Jaloi's stern face.
Here, Strangyard, is anything wrong?
The archivist appeared, a lanky, flapping shape, materializing from grey obscurity.
No, no, I just wanted to.
He stopped, staring at Vorshava's tear-stained face. Oh,
I'm so terribly sorry. How rude of me. I will leave you.
He turned to lurch off into the mist once more.
Don't go!
Strangely, it was Vorshava who spoke. Do not leave us, father.
Walk with us?
Strangyard looked at her, then to Jaloi.
I do not wish to intrude, lady. I fear I was thinking only of something I found in Morgaini's book.
Eye patch askew, thin fringe of reddish hair curling in the damp. He looked like a startled woodpecker. He seemed about to bolt once more, but the witchwoman raised a calming hand.
Walk with us, Strangyard, as Vorshava said. Perhaps your need is one for which my talents are better suited.
The priest looked at her nervously.
Come, we will walk back toward the others as we talk.
Strangyard was still carrying the loose sheaves of Morgaini's book in his hand. After a few silent paces, he began to leaf through them.
I'm afraid I've lost the section, he said, shuffling the parchments. I thought it might be significant. It was a bit about magic. The art. That's what Morgaini's called it. I'm amazed by the things he knew, quite amazed. I would never have dreamt.
A triumphant smile came to his face.
Here it is, he squinted. Wonderful way with words.
They walked several more paces in silence.
Will you read? Jaloi asked at last. Oh, of course.
Strangyard cleared his throat.
In truth, articles useful to the art seem to fall into two broad categories,
the priest began.
Those whose worth is bound in themselves, and those whose worth is bound in their derivation. In contradiction to popular superstition, a herb gathered in a graveyard is not generally useful because it came from such a place, but rather because of the herb itself. Since a graveyard may be the only place that herb is found, the connection becomes established and is then almost impossible to disentangle. The other category of useful objects are usually made objects, and their virtue is in their shaping or their raw beginnings. The Scythi, who have long possessed secrets of crafting hidden from mortals, made many things whose creation itself was a practice of the art. Although the Scythi would not exactly term it so. Thus, the virtue of these objects is in their making. The famous arrows of Vindameo are an example. Carved from common wood and fletched with the feathers of ordinary birds, yet each one is a talisman of great worth. Other objects take their power from the stuff of their making. The great swords alluded to in Nicey's lost book are examples here. All seem to derive their worth from their materials, although the crafting of each was a mighty task. Minia, King Fingal's sword, was made of the iron keel of his boat, iron brought to Ostenade by the Rimmersman sea raiders out of the Lost West. Thorn, most recently the sword of Prester John's noblest knight, Sir Camaris, was forged from the glowing metals of a fallen star. Like Minyar's iron, something foreign to Ostenard. And Sorrow, the sword that Nicese claims Ineluki of the Scythi used to slay his own father, the Earl King, was made of Scythi witchwood and iron, two elements long thought to be antithetical and unmixable. Thus, such objects derive their strength primarily, it would seem, from the unearthly origins of their substance. Stories tell, however, that powerful spells of making were also wound in the forging of all these three blades, so the power of the great swords may come from both their substance and their making. Tituno,
the hunting horn crafted in fabled Mesutoa, from the tooth of the dragon Hirohebi, is another clear example of how sometimes an object of power may be made by both the crafting and the materials crafted.
Strangyard broke off. It goes on to talk of other things. It is all fascinating, of course. What a scholar that man was. But I thought the section on the swords might be interesting.
Jilloe nodded her head slowly.
It is. I wondered about these three swords that have become the object of our hopes. Morgaini seems to make a good argument as to the reason for their value. Perhaps they will indeed be useful against Ineluki. It is good that you found that, Strangyard.
The priest's pink cheeks went a deeper red.
Too kind. You're too kind.
Jilloe cocked her head.
I hear the others. Are you composed, Vorshaver?
Vorshaver nodded her head.
I am not such a fool as you think me, she said quietly.
The witch woman laughed.
I do not think you are a fool particularly. I think most people are foolish, and I count myself as well. For here I am, without a roof, wandering over the grasslands like a stray heifer. Sometimes obvious foolishness is the only answer to grave problems.
Hmm, said Strangyard, baffled.
Hmm.
The ragged band continued out onto the fog-ridden meadowlands, heading south toward the river Imstreka, which meandered along the breadth of the high Thrythings. They made camp on the open plain, shivering in the rain-sodden wind, huddling close to their small fire. Jilloe made a soup of herbs and roots she had gathered. It was filling and warmed the stomach, but Deornoth mourned the absence of something more toothsome.
Tomorrow let me go farther afield, my lord,
he implored Joshua as they sat by the fire. All the others but Jilloe had wrapped themselves in their cloaks to sleep, bundled close together like a family of sleeping kittens. The witch woman had gone a-wandering.
I know I could find a hare or two, and the underbrush must be full of grouse, even in this cold summer. We have had no meat for several days.
Joshua permitted himself a chilly smile.
I wish I could say yes, faithful friend, but I need your strong arms and good wit close by. These people can scarcely walk another step. Those who can still walk, that is. No, a brace of hares would be tasty indeed, but I must keep you here. Besides, Valada Jilloe tells me that one can live years without tasting meat.
Deornoth grimaced.
But who would want to?
He studied his prince carefully. Joshua's already slender frame had grown even thinner. The play of his bones was plain beneath the skin, with what little fat he had worn long gone. The prince's high forehead and pale eyes made him seem a statue of some ancient philosopher monk, his gaze fixed always upon the infinite, while the busy world spun on before him, ignored. The fire hissed, working away at the damp wood.
One other question, then, my lord,
Deornoth said softly.
Are we so sure of this stone of farewell that we should drag these sick, wounded people across the Thrythings in search of it? I speak no ill of Jilloe, who is plainly a good-hearted soul. But to go so far?
The edge of Erkinland is only a few leagues to the west. Surely we could find a loyal heart in one of the towns of the Hasuvala. Even if they were too frightened of your brother the king to give us shelter, we could find food and drink and warmer clothing for our wounded, surely.
Joshua sighed and rubbed his eyes.
Perhaps, Deornoth. Perhaps. Believe me, the thought has occurred to me.
He stretched his long legs before him, nudging at the edge of the coals with his boot heel.
But we cannot risk it, nor can we spare the time. Every hour we walk in the open means more time for one of Elias' patrols to find us.
or something worse to catch us unprotected. No, the only place that it seems we can go is Jaloi's Stone of Farewell. So the sooner we do, the better. Erkinland is lost to us, at least for now, perhaps forever. The prince shook his head and fell into thought once more. Deornoth sighed and poked at the fire. They reached the banks of the Imstrecher in the morning of their third day on the grasslands. The wide river shone faintly beneath the grey sky, a dim streak of silver passing like a dream through the dark, damp meadows. The water's voice was as muted as its sheen, a faint murmur like distant conversation. Joshua's people were content to pause and rest a while on the river banks, enjoying the sound and sight of the first swiftly moving waters they had seen since deep in Aldeorta forest. When Gutrun and Vorsheva made known their plan to follow the river downstream a short distance, to where they could bathe their limbs in privacy, Joshua was quick to object, worried for their safety. When Jaloi offered to go with them, the prince reluctantly consented. It was difficult to think of a situation beyond the witch woman's enormous competence.
Ah, it is somehow as if I never left, Vorsheva said, dangling her feet in the current.
They had chosen a sandy bank where a stand of birch trees in midstream widened the river course, shielding them from the view of their distant fellow travellers. Her voice was careless, though her face belied her.
It is like when I was a little girl.
She frowned as she splashed water on the numerous scratches covering her legs.
But it is so cold.
Duchess Gutrun had loosened the neck of her garment. She stood a little way out from the bank, the river eddying around her plump calves, as she splashed water on her throat and scrubbed at her face.
It is not so bad, she laughed. The river Gratavask that runs by our home in Elvritshale. Now that is cold water. Every year at spring, the maidens of the town go down to the river to bathe. I did when I was young.
She straightened up, staring at nothing.
The men must stay inside all morning, on penalty of a beating, so the maidens can splash in the Gratavask. And cold. The river is born from the snows of the northern mountains. You have not heard shrieking until you hear 100 young girls plunge into a chilly river on an Avril morning.
She laughed again.
There is a story, you know, about one young man who was determined to see the Gratavask maidens. It is a famous tale in Remesland. Perhaps you have heard it?
She broke off, water sluicing from her cupped hands.
Vorsheva, are you ill?
The Thrithings woman was bent over, her face pale as milk.
Just a pain,
she said harshly, straightening up.
It will go away soon. See, I am better now. Tell your story.
Gutrun looked at her suspiciously. Before the Duchess could say anything, Jaloi spoke up from her seat on the bank nearby, where she had been tidying Leneth's hair with a comb made from fishbone.
The story must wait.
The witchwoman's tone was sharp.
See, we are not alone.
Vorsheva and the Duchess turned to follow Jaloi's pointing finger. Across the meadows, some 3 or 4 furlongs away to the south, a mounted rider stood poised on a hillock. He was much too far away for his face to be discernible, but there was little doubt he was looking in their direction. All the women stared back, even Leleth, her strange eyes wide. After several silent moments in which it seemed that no hearts beat, the solitary figure turned his horse and rode down the hillock, vanishing from sight.
How frightening!
The Duchess said, clutching the neck of her dress closed with a damp hand.
Who is it? Those horrible Norns?
I cannot say,
Jaloi rasped.
But we should return to tell the others, in case Joshua did not see. We must be concerned with any strangers now, be they friend or foe.
Borsheva shuddered. Her face was still pale.
There are no friendly strangers on these grasslands, she said.
The women's news was enough to convince Joshua that they could dally no longer. Unhappily, the company shouldered their few possessions and set off again, following the course of the Imstreke east alongside the border of the now distant forest, a thin dark strip on the misty northern horizon. They saw no one else all afternoon.
These seem like fertile lands, Deonoth said as they searched for a spot to camp.
Isn't it strange that we have seen no people beside that lone rider?
One rider is enough, Joshua was grim.
My people have never liked it here, so near to the old forest,
Forsheva said, and shivered.
There are spirits of the dead beneath the trees.
Joshua sighed.
These are things I would have laughed at a year ago. Now I have seen them, or things even worse. God save me, what a world this has become.
Jaloi looked up from where she was making a bed of grass for young Leleth.
It has always been the same world, Prince Joshua, she said. It is only that in these troubled hours, things are seen more clearly. The lamps of cities blur many shadows that are plain beneath the moon.
Deonoth awoke in the deeps of night, his heart beating swiftly. He had been dreaming. King Elias had become a spindly thing of grasping claws and red eyes, clinging to Prince Joshua's back. Joshua could not see him, and did not even seem to know that his brother was there. In the dream, Deonoth tried to tell him, but Joshua did not listen, only smiled as he walked through the streets of Urchester with the terrible Elias thing riding his back like a deformed baby. Every time Joshua bent to pat the head of a child or give a coin to a beggar, Elias reached out to undo the good work when Joshua had passed, snatching the coin back or scratching the child's face with dirty nails. Soon an angry crowd followed behind Joshua, shouting for his punishment. But the prince went blithely on, unknowing, even as Deonoth screamed and pointed at the evil thing riding the prince's shoulders. Awake on the benighted grasslands, Deonoth shook his head, trying to pull free from the clinging sense of disquiet. Elias' dream face, wizened and spiteful, would not leave his mind. He sat up and looked around. All the camp was sleeping but for Valada Jaloi, who sat dreaming or pondering over the last coals of the dying fire. He lay back and tried to sleep, but could not for fear the dream would return. At last, disgusted by his own weak-heartedness, he got up and quietly shook out his cloak, then walked to the fire and sat down near Jaloi. The witchwoman did not look up at his approach. Her face was red-splashed by firelight, eyes staring unblinkingly into the embers, as though nothing else existed. Her lips were moving, but no sound came forth. Deonoth felt a chill creep up the back of his neck. What was she doing? Should he wake her? Jaloi's mouth continued to work. Her voice rose to a whisper.
Amarasu, where are you? Your spirit is dim, and I am weak.
Deonoth's hand stopped an inch from the witch woman's rough sleeve.
If ever you share, let it be now.
Jaloi's voice hissed like the wind.
Oh, please.
A tear, scarlet shot, trickled down her weathered cheek. Her despairing whisper drove Deonoth back to his makeshift bed. He did not fall back into sleep for some time, but lay staring up at the blue-white stars. He was awakened once more before dawn, this time by Joshua. The prince shook Deonoth's arm, then lifted his handless right wrist to his lips, gesturing for silence. The knight looked up to see a clot of darkness to the west, thicker even than the general obscurity of night, approaching along the line of the river. The muffled sound of hoofbeats rolled toward them over the grass. Deornoth's heart raced. He felt on the ground for his scabbard, and was soothed only a little by the feeling of his sword hilt beneath his fingers. Joshua crawled away to wake the others.
"Where is the witch woman?"
Deornoth whispered urgently, but the prince was too far away to hear, so he crawled over to where Strangyard lay. The older man, sleeping lightly, was awake in a moment.
"Be still," the knight murmured. "There are riders coming."
"Who?"
Strangyard asked. Deornoth shook his head. The oncoming riders, still little more than shadows, split almost noiselessly into several groups, sweeping wide around the encampment. Deornoth had to marvel at their silent horsemanship, even as he cursed his party's lack of bows and arrows. A folly to fight with swords against mounted men, if men they were. He thought he could count 24 attackers, although any estimate was dubious in this half-light. Deornoth got to his feet, even as a few shadowy figures around him did the same. Joshua, nearby, drew Nadel from its sheath. The sudden hiss of metal against leather seemed as loud as a shout. The surrounding figures reined up, and for a moment utter silence fell once more. Someone passing a stone's throw away would never have suspected the presence of a single soul, let alone two forces at battle-ready. A voice broke the stillness.
"Trespassers, you walk on the land of Clan Merdin. Lay down your arms."
Flint rang on steel. Then a torch blossomed behind the nearest figures, throwing long shadows across the campsite. Mounted men, hooded and cloaked, surrounded Joshua's band with a ring of spears.
"Lay down your weapons,"
the voice said again in thickly accented westerling.
"You are prisoners of the Rand Warders. We will kill you if you resist."
Several more torches flared alight. The night was suddenly full of armed shadows.
"Merciful Aiden," Duchess Gutrun said from somewhere nearby. "Sweet Elysia, what now?"
A large shape pushed toward her, Isorn going to comfort his mother.
"Do not move,"
the disembodied voice barked out. A moment later, one of the riders walked his horse forward, his spear point lowering, catching a glint of torchlight.
"I hear women," the rider said. "Do nothing foolish, and they will be spared. We are not beasts."
"And what about the rest?"
Joshua said, stepping forward into the light. "We have many here wounded and sick. What will you do with us?" The rider leaned down to stare at Joshua, momentarily exposing his hooded features. He had a rough face, with a shaggy braided beard and scarred cheeks. Heavy bracelets clinked on his wrists. Deornoth felt his tension ease somewhat. At least their enemies were mortal men. The rider spat into the dark grass.
"You are prisoners. You ask no questions. The March Thane will decide."
He turned to his fellows.
"Osbern, Conrad, round them in a circle to march."
He wheeled his horse to supervise, as Joshua, Deornoth, and the others were herded at spear point into the ring of torchlight.
"Your March Thane will be unhappy if you mistreat us," Joshua said.
The leader laughed.
"He will be more unhappy with me if you are not at the wagons by sunhigh."
He turned to one of the other riders.
"All?"
"All, Hartvig. 6 men, 2 women, 1 child. Only 1 cannot walk."
He indicated Sangfugl with the butt of his spear.
"Put him on a horse," Hartvig said. "Over the saddle, no matter. We must ride fast."
Even as they were prodded into movement, Deornoth sidled closer to Joshua.
"It could be worse," he whispered to the prince. "It could have been the Norns who caught us, instead of Thrything's men."
The prince did not reply. Deornoth touched his arm, feeling the muscles tense as barrel staves beneath his fingers.
"What's wrong, Prince Joshua?" Have the Thrything's men thrown in with Elias? My lord.
One of the riders looked down, mouth set in a humorless, gap-toothed grin.
Quiet, stone dwellers, he snarled. Save your breath for walking.
Joshua turned a haunted face toward Deonoth.
Didn't you hear him? The prince whispered. Didn't you hear him?
Deonoth was alarmed.
What?
6 men, 2 women, and a child, Joshua hissed, looking from side to side.
2 women. Where is Vorshaver?
The rider slapped a spear butt against his shoulder, and the prince lapsed into anguished silence. They trudged on between the horsemen as dawn began to smolder in the eastern sky. As she lay on her hard bed in the darkened servants' quarters, Rachel the dragon imagined she could hear the gibbet creaking, even above the howling wind that skirled through the battlements. 9 more bodies, the Chancellor Helfkanes among them, were swaying above the Nearula gate tonight, dancing helplessly to the wind's fierce music. Nearer at hand, somebody was crying.
Sarah? Is that you? Rachel hissed. Sarah!
The moaning of the gale died down.
Yes, mistress,
came the muffled reply.
Blessed Rhiab, what are you sobbing about? You'll wake the others.
Besides Sarah and Rachel, there were only 3 other women now sleeping in the maid's quarters, but all 5 cots were huddled together to conserve heat in the large, chilly room. Sarah seemed to struggle to compose herself, but when she answered, her voice was still shaken by sobs.
I'm afraid, Mistress Rachel. Of what, fool girl? The wind?
Rachel sat up, holding the thin blanket closely around her.
It's blowing up a storm, but you've heard wind before.
Torchlight, bleeding beneath the doorway, revealed the faint shape of Sarah's pale face.
It's my Gamma used to say.
The maid coughed wetly.
Gamma said that nights like this are when dead spirits walk. That you can hear the voices in the wind.
Rachel was grateful for the darkness that hid her own discomfited shiver. If there ever would be such a night, tonight seemed a likely choice. The wind had been raging like a wounded animal since sundown, wailing among the hayholt's chimneys, and scratching at the doors and windows with insistent, twiggy fingers. She made her voice firm.
The dead don't walk in my castle, idiot girl. Now go back to sleep before you give the others nightmares.
Rachel lowered herself back down onto her pallet, trying to find a position that would ease her knotted back.
Go to sleep. Sarah,
she said,
the wind can't hurt you. And there'll be work in plenty tomorrow, the good Lord knows, just to picking up what the wind's blown down. I'm sorry.
The pale face sank. After a few sniffling minutes, Sarah was silent once more. Rachel stared upward into the blackness and listened to the night's restless voices. She might have slept. It was hard to tell when all was in darkness. But Rachel knew that she had been listening to a sound beneath the windsong for some time. It was a quiet, stealthy scratching, a dry sound like bird claws on a slate roof. Something was at the door. She might have been sleeping, but now suddenly she was terribly awake. When she turned her head to the side, she could see a shadow slipping along the strip of light below the door. The scratching became louder, and with it came the sound of someone crying.
Sarah!
Rachel whispered, thinking that the noise had awakened the maid, but there was no response. As she listened wide-eyed in the dark, she knew that the strange thin sound was coming from the hallway, from whatever stood outside her locked door.
Please,
someone whispered there.
Please!
Blood pounding in her head, Rachel sat up, then silently placed her bare feet on the cold stone floor. Could she be dreaming? She seemed so very wide awake, but it sounded like a boy's voice, like... The scratching took on an impatient quality, which quickly began to sound like fearfulness. Whatever it was, she thought, it must be frightened to scratch so... A wandering spirit, a homeless thing walking lone and lorn on this blustery night, looking for its long-vanished bed. Rachel crept closer to the door, silent as snow. Her heart labored. The wind in the battlements stilled. She was alone in the dark, with the breathing of the slumbering maids and the pitiful scraping of what stood beyond the door.
"Please,"
the voice said again, softly, weakly.
"I'm scared."
She traced the sign of the tree on her breast, then grasped the bolt and drew it back. Though the moment of choosing was past, she drew the door open slowly. Even with the choice made, she feared what she would see. The solitary torch against the far corridor outlined the faint figure, its thatch of hair, its scarecrow-thin limbs. The face that turned to her, startled eyes showing their whites, was blackened as though burnt.
"Help me,"
it said, staggering through the doorway into her arms.
"Simon!"
Rachel cried, and beyond all sense felt her heart overflowing. He had come back, through fire, through death.
Simon?
The boy said, his eyes sagging closed from exhaustion and pain.
"Simon's dead. He died in the fire. Priorities killed him."
He went limp in her arms. Head whirling, she pulled his sagging form through the doorway, letting him slide to the floor, then shot the bolt firmly home and went looking for a candle. The wind cried mockingly. If other voices cried within it, there were none that Rachel recognized.
"It's Jeremias, the chandler's boy,"
Sarah said wonderingly, as Rachel washed the dried blood from his face. In the candlelight, Jeremiah's dark, socketed eyes and scratched cheeks made him seem almost a wizened old man.
"But he was a chubby thing," Rachel said.
Her mind was boiling with the boy's words, but things must be done one at a time. What would these useless girls think if she let herself go all to pieces?
"What's happened to him?" she growled. "He's thin as a stave."
The maids had all gathered around, blankets wrapped as cloaks around their nightdresses. Jael, no longer as stout as she had once been, owing to the greater burden of work all the remaining girls shared, stared at the senseless youth.
"I thought someone said Jeremias ran away," she said, frowning. "Why did he come back?" "Don't be foolish,"
Rachel said, trying to tug Jeremiah's tattered shirt over his head without waking him.
"If he had run away, how would he have gotten back into Hayholt at the middle of night? Flown?" "Then tell us where he has been,"
one of the other girls said. It was a measure of Rachel's shock at Jeremiah's entrance that this near impertinence went completely unremarked upon by the mistress of chambermaids.
"Help me turn him over," she said,
working the shirt free.
"We'll put him to sleep in... Oh, Elysia, Mother of God!"
She fell into astonished silence. Sarah burst into tears beside her. The youth's back was crisscrossed with deep, bloody weals.
I feel sick,"
Jael mumbled, then lurched away.
"Don't be a fool,"
Rachel said, regaining her composure once more.
"Splash some water on your face, then bring me the rest of the basin. This wet cloth alone won't do. And take that sheet from the bed Hepzibah used to sleep in, and tear strips for bandages. Rehab's pain. Do I have to do everything myself?"
It took the whole sheet and part of another one. His legs had been scourged, too. Jeremias awoke just before dawn. His eyes at first roamed the room without seeing anything. But after a time he seemed to regain his wits. Sarah, sadness and pity shining through her homely face, as though it were glass, gave him some water to drink.
"Where am I?" he asked at last.
You're in the servants' quarters, boy, Rachel said briskly, as you should know. Now what sort of mischief have you been up to?
He stared at her groggily for a moment.
You're Rachel the dragon, he said at last.
Despite their weariness and fright and the lateness of the hour, the chambermaids were hard put to suppress their smiles. Rachel, strangely, did not seem angered in the slightest.
I'm Rachel, she agreed. Now where have you been, boy? We heard that you ran away. You thought I was Simon, Jeremiah said wonderingly, staring around the chamber. He was my friend. But he's dead, isn't he? Am I dead? You're not dead. What happened to you?
Rachel leaned forward to brush Jeremiah's tangled hair out of his eyes. Her hand lingered for an instant on his cheek.
You're safe now. Talk to us.
He seemed about to slide back into sleep, but after a moment he opened his eyes again. When he spoke, it was more plainly than before.
I did try to run away, he said. When the king's soldiers beat my master Jacob and drove him out the gate, I tried to run away that night, but the guards caught me. They gave me to Inch.
Rachel frowned.
That animal?
Jeremiah's eyes widened.
He's worse than any animal. He's a devil. He said I would be his apprentice. Down in the furnaces. In the forges. He thinks he's a king down there.
The boy's face screwed up, and he suddenly burst into tears.
He says he's Dr. Inch now. He beat me and he used me.
Rachel leaned forward to blot his cheeks with her kerchief. The girls made the sign of the tree. Jeremiah's sobbing diminished.
It's worse than anything down there. You said something, boy, Rachel said briskly. Something about the king's counselor. About Simon. Say it again.
The boy opened his brimming eyes wide.
Priorates killed him. Simon and Morganis. The priest went there with troops. Morganis fought with him, but the chamber burned down and Simon and the doctor died. And how could you know that? She snapped a little harshly. How could such as you know that? Priorates said so himself. He comes down to see Inch. Sometimes he just brags, like about killing Morganis.